Hello, friends. Today is the 27th of July, 2013, and we are continuing with the Esoteric Astrology Adventures. We've reached program 113A, and let's see, make this just a little bit bigger. Right. And we have been discussing the necessity to know the point in evolution and to determine upon what stage of the path of return the dweller in the form, macrocosmic or microcosmic, is standing. We cannot know which of the planetary influences are conditioning the centers in the fourth kingdom of nature, or in a human being, or in a solar system, unless we know the stage. And there's an implication here. The implication, I think, that different planets can condition the centers at different times. So we sometimes say, well, what planet in the solar system does that, what center in the solar logos does that planet actually represent? But perhaps that could change as well. For instance, when we look at the heart center, I think I've discussed this with you, we could look at the Sun or Jupiter, either one, but we also might look at Neptune, and in a certain respect we might look at Venus as well. So different planets are associated with the different chakras at different times in the development or different stages on the path of return of the dweller in the form. If Mars is to condition the sacral center, which about which it, in relation to which it has a pretty strong influence, it will be earlier than the developmental period in which it conditions, in which Uranus conditions the sacral center. The whole subject is constantly shifting and changing, just as the individual human being is constantly changing his focus, or is to be found working first in one area of his body of force, the three substantial bodies, and then in another. When a logos, for instance, changes his sustained attention, the center upon which he is focusing will receive stimulation. You can kind of wonder whether the rounds that happen in a planetary chain or the larger scheme rounds are not simply a matter of the focus, of the sustained focus over a period of time of the planetary logos. Should rounds be necessarily absolutely sequential? Well, I think there is reason to think that they may not be absolutely sequential. And just the way, over a much shorter period of time, we change our focus from one center to another, so the solar logos can do the same. He can work within triangles and not necessarily follow follow from one chakra to the next in a sequential manner. The fact that different triangles of chakras are activated and different points within those triangles at different times according to the monadic ray gives a hint in this regard. So now we are at the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure, number 133A. Really, I began it just a little while ago. Just 4 minutes ago. Each changing personality sees a different ray force enter. Let's just say yes, but not necessarily, because there can be sequences of lives which have the same personality ray, but in general we might say that it's always possible to change the personality ray. Even if we don't change sun sign, the personality ray could remain the same. I mean, we've seen people with the six ray personality, they have the sun in Capricorn or the sun in Gemini. So it's possible to have different astrological sun signs and still have the same personality ray. Take care of that, right. But anyway, in general, it's certainly possible. Each changing personality sees a different ray force enter, and each ray governs or transmits its force through one or other of the seven centers. Okay, so the sun sign in each incarnation will be different. Well, again, not necessarily. We've even seen people die in the same sign in which they were born. But DK tells us about this in A Treatise on White Magic, and that the life thread will be taken up in the next life in the same sign in which death occurred in the previous life. How literally this is the case, and to what extent the different kinds of planets, different kinds of progressions will be involved, we do not know. If you're born, let's say, with the sun in Aries, and you die somehow with the sun in Gemini or the sun in Cancer, will the next incarnation, in other words, let's just say you die in Aries again, only the progressed sun is in Cancer, will the next incarnation be taken up with the sun in Cancer because it's your progressed position, or will it be taken up with the sun in Aries? We need to do, of course, the reincarnational research in order to discover what actually happens, and we're not in a position at this time to do that reincarnational research. The sun sign in each incarnation will be different, often, not necessarily, leading necessarily to a different rising sign, and therefore to a complete new set of planetary influences. Well, if the sun sign were different, and the rising sign were different, then this would be the case. But it is possible to have the same rising sign for several lives, perhaps seven lives, or even nine. Even nine lives are possible. And I wonder if we can find this. Let's see what we can find. Nine lives rising. Or let's just say seven rising. And rising, setting the sun. The rising sign in small measure. Here it is. This indicates the life goal for a particular life cycle, or else over a period of seven lives. The last two constitute the greater zodiac. Well, will the rising sign in one life indicate the life goal over a period of the next seven lives if that rising sign does not repeat itself over the next seven lives? Probably that is not the case. Probably back here on page 31 of Esoteric Astrology, we are dealing with the idea that the rising sign can stay the same. We already know that people can be born with the same sun sign, at least if what DK holds to be true is actually true, and we suspect it is true or trust that it is true. People who die in the same sign in which they have been born, with the sun in the same sign in which they have been born, will be born with that same sign as their sun sign in the next life. Whether or not the decanate will be the same, that is different. And this period of seven lives, perhaps seven lives, the decanate of the rising sign can, however, be different. And this would necessarily bring the individual under different rulers, because the different decanates have different planetary rulers, and so do the different Dwadashamsas have different planetary rulers, and the different decanates will be associated with different extra zodiacal constellations. But we're talking about a situation of mutability and change here, and probably in the majority of cases, there are different sun signs and rising signs. And thus the centers in the vital body come under varying pressure and stimulation, let's say from different planets, which are the rulers of the different sun signs and rising signs. In one life, the stimulation applied may tend to vivify the solar plexus or to drive its energies upward to a higher point of transference, the heart center. Let's just say we have a strong signs ruled by Mars and or Neptune. Suppose we have Mars and Neptune in opposition. Let's just say, suppose you're born with the, let's say, Sun in Scorpio, ruled by Mars, and Pisces rising, ruled by Neptune, or Cancer rising, ruled by Neptune. And let's suppose that in your chart, there's a square between Neptune and the Mars, or an opposition. There's a chance there for the Neptune to act as an upward drawing magnetic energy upon the Martian energies. The Scorpio-Mars situation would put an emphasis upon the solar plexus, and maybe upon aspiration to a degree, especially if, let us say, we were born with the Sun in Scorpio and Mars in Sagittarius, giving great six-ray aspiration, upward inclination. And then, let's say, Neptune, we were born with Cancer rising, and there would be a square because Neptune would be in Virgo, let us say. So the emphasis would be upon the rising sign Cancer and the its esoteric ruler Neptune, and not upon the sun sign Scorpio and its ordinary ruler, Mars. Of course, it's also the esoteric ruler which might heighten the aspiration. So in one life, the stimulation applied may tend to vivify the solar plexus or to drive its energies upward. So one idea here is vivification, and the other is driving upward to its higher point of transference. And that higher point of transference, there are two points within the solar plexus center, according to Meditation 2 in Dina 2. So there would be a vivification, and there could be an interplay between those two points, the higher and the lower. The higher tends to be ruled more by Neptune and the lower by Mars. But in general, the solar plexus of disciples is ruled by Neptune and can lift the energy. Let's just suppose Jupiter, which rules the heart center, is somehow involved with that combination of energies. Let's just suppose we have Jupiter mediating between an opposition between Neptune and Mars. Jupiter in a trine position, let us say, to Neptune, and in a sextile to Mars. Then the heart center would be a destination, and the magnetic power of Jupiter would combine with the upward tending energy of Neptune and draw away from simply the activation of the solar plexus. So many things are possible, and we have to look at everybody's chart in terms of the chakras which are represented. And we see what kinds of dynamics can be there, and whether energy flows can be induced or cooperated with. somehow successfully undertaken by adding the will of the individual to the natural tendency of the energies to rise. Or perhaps we'd have to fight against that, and the natural tendency might be just to stay where they are, but we'd have to apply the will to help them rise. In another life, it may be focused in the throat center, let us say under the planet Saturn, and by indirect activity affect the sacral center. Let's just say that there are people for whom Uranus represents the sacral center. It doesn't necessarily always, but in the charts DK gives, it pretty well represents the sacral center, and there is some trine relationship, close trine relationship with Saturn, or maybe a square opposition. There will be a pull towards the throat center, especially, let us say, if the rising sign is Capricorn, so Saturn is the ruler of the rising sign, and the sun sign may be Aquarius. It may rule the sacral center. Or maybe, again, Mars will be the ruler of the sacral center, as it sometimes is, maybe often is, in less developed types. We might have some Mars or Saturn aspect. And going with the Capricorn rising sign, Saturn would represent the throat center, and let's say Aries is the sun sign, and Mars is the ordinary ruler and somehow represents the sacral center, and there's an aspect between Saturn and Mars. So study the energy dynamics in anybody's life, what they are trying to do, where the energy may be centralized, may also be the cause of disease, that type of centralization, if there's excessive focus, and see not only what's going on, but what might be induced. So in another, it may be seen to be focused in the throat center, and by indirect activity affecting the sacral center, and under the major law of attraction, produce a raising of forces to the higher creative focus. Now later, Uranus itself might be involved in the throat center, because there comes a time when the throat center is ruled by the seventh ray. It's later in development. Maybe it's could be even at the first initiation, when one's speech begins to take on a particularly magical and effective quality. So we cannot necessarily say what planet will necessarily represent what chakra. It depends upon the stage of evolution. At a certain point in evolution, Uranus will represent the head center of the individual, but it will have to be rather higher point of evolution than the time when it represents the throat center or perhaps the sacral center. Maybe you can follow what I'm saying here. I know it would be nice if I could somehow draw all of this out and use the visual imagery to make clear what I meant, but I'm hoping you can follow it. I repeat it enough, and then maybe at some point someone can come in with visual imagery and perhaps add a degree of clarity to what I'm otherwise saying here. As you well know, theoretically, the science of occultism is the science of energies. And for that reason, very closely related to Uranus. Occult mind is the Uranian mind, and the science of occultism is closely Uranian. It deviates from standard science under Saturn and under Mars and under the more conventional expression of Uranus. So it's the science of energies and of the forces upon which they make their impact. And just remember, energy and force must meet together, and thus the work is done. So energy will have its impact upon force. Force is more a confined energy, or an energy directed towards a specific target, and energy itself is more expansive and less contained than a force, contained by form, that is. Okay, this when concerning man, the individual, and the centers within the human vehicle, major and minor, lead to the science of Laya Yoga or the science of the four centers. There is a very good Hindu book on Laya Yoga. I think it's called Laya Yoga, and it's a very ancient science, and maybe even in a way it was Lemurian in its day, because so much of what the Lemurians had to do was to gain control over their physical body through focus within the etheric body. That was initiation for them. And when we take the first initiation, we are somewhat getting a grip upon ourselves. Vulcan can be there. And Uranus, interestingly enough, is a planet of control. And especially inner control. So we oftentimes think of Saturn as a planet of control. It is, but so is Uranus, and so is Vulcan. And there's Leo at that first initiation, and we have seen how Leo can be related to Saturn via the triangle Sirius-Leo-Saturn, or Leo-Saturn-Shambhala, and how Uranus is a hierarchical ruler of Leo, and how Vulcan is a planet often veiled by the Sun. Anyway, all of those planets can be involved at the first initiation, and DK tells us in a way that they are when he tells us that the etheric and the physical nature are contending. So there we have Uranus and Saturn, or maybe Uranus and the Moon, or Uranus and Mars, with Uranus representing the etheric nature and Moon, Saturn, or Mars representing the physical. I had something further I wanted to say, but that will have to be it for the moment. These, again, according to astrological deduction, come under... Oh, yes, I wanted to say that Vulcan, too. We're told that there's a great presence of Vulcan and Pluto before the first initiation. And they are like arrows heading in opposite directions, with perhaps the downward-pointing arrow being quite a good symbol for Vulcan. And we're told the upward-pointing arrow of death is the proper symbol for Pluto. So something goes down, the spirit goes down, and that in some ways forces the residue to come up and be expiated. And a lot of that happens before the first degree, so it's very drastic. These again, according to astrological deduction, Vulcan has a lot to do with the etheric body. If we look at an opposition between the Sun and the Moon is related to the dense physical vehicle, or a square, let us say, Sun and Moon. And the Sun is, in a way, hiding or veiling Vulcan, which has a connection with the etheric nature, particularly. There are many assignments here. Even the Moon can relate to the etheric nature and to the violet devas, but we do know that the Agni Chaitans, which are closely associated with Vulcan, come under the etheric body. They are found in the etheric body, but also maybe older and somehow less advanced Agni Chaitans found within the, opening the window here, found within the dense physical. So these, again, according to astrological deduction, come under the influence of certain planetary rulers. These relate to them in turn to certain great triangles of force formed of three conditioning constellations. Yes, that's interesting. Let's see how he does this. So we have the four centers. They come under the influence of certain planetary rulers, and these relate them to certain great triangles of force. Like, for instance, let's look at Mars. Solar plexus center, ruled by Mars, relates the solar plexus through Mars to the triangle Aries, Leo, Capricorn, through a first-rate triangle. Okay. And to the triangle Taurus, Scorpio, Sagittarius. That's a fourth-rate triangle. And to the triangle Virgo, Sagittarius, and Pisces, which is a sixth-rate triangle. You see, in each one there's a rulership, isn't there? I mean, Mars is the ruler, and Sagittarius is also found in the fifth-rate triangle. Fifth-rate triangle is Leo, Sagittarius, and Aquarius. And also, so we have the fourth-rate triangle, the fifth-rate triangle, and the sixth-rate triangle, to which that solar plexus position, ruled by Mars, is related. And so somehow these energies, and especially the one I will underline, can be brought into connection with the solar plexus. Now, I'm not sure he uses hierarchical rulers so much, but he certainly uses the esoteric rulers. Here I've got hierarchical Mars in relation to Sagittarius, but if we just stuck to the ordinary ruler and to the exoteric ruler or esoteric ruler of Scorpio, we'd have at least two of the triangles brought into relation with a particular chakra. Yes, that's very interesting how we might bring that energy to bear. Now, as I've often said, according to the ray, we may have certain triangles related to a chakra. In other words, let's just say Sagittarius brings through another approach here, okay? Another approach. If Sagittarius brings in the majority of the sixth ray at this time, then the sixth ray triangle of Virgo, Sagittarius, and Pisces will be closely related to the chakra which the sixth ray mostly rules, the solar plexus. And then we might be able also to draw in the fifth ray triangle. After all, the solar plexus center, counting from above of the major centers, is really the fifth chakra, interestingly enough, not the sixth, even though it's ruled by the sixth ray. And we might be able to bring in the conflicts of the fourth ray triangle, where Scorpio is very prominent, or even the first ray and seventh ray triangle, where Aries is prominent. Of course, the other two points of the triangle would be less related. But wherever Mars can be found to be effective, we can bring in that particular sign or triangle to which it is related. Now, how to do this in a practical way, of course, we'd have to think about the life circumstances of the individual. We'd have to look closely at how he might use those particular energies, and at different times they might be more available. For instance, a person who has a very strong solar plexus polarization, let's just say that at the time of the Sagittarius full moon, I see the goal, I reach the goal, and then I see another, the major sixth-ray triangle of Virgo, Sagittarius, Pisces might be very strong, strong stimulation. And, you know, but we might also say that such a time might be also powerful for Jupiter. Jupiter is strong in Sagittarius, And Jupiter rules the heart center, let's say, and maybe there's a contending going on between the heart center and the solar plexus center, and that could be a time, because Jupiter does rule Pisces and Jupiter does rule Sagittarius, that this six-ray triangle would have some opposition by a second-ray triangle emphasizing the heart. If we look at the second-ray triangle, we will see that it's Gemini, Virgo, and Pisces, that Pisces would be strong in opposing the stimulation of the solar plexus center. In a way, Pisces is interesting because, like Virgo, it stimulates both the solar plexus and the heart center. Everything depends on the stage of evolution in which the individual finds himself. Therefore, the emphasis laid upon the science of triangles and its including science of esoteric astrology. Well, let's just say that the science of triangles is said to be the very basis of the science of esoteric astrology, the foundational science within it, but DK has a good reason for saying that esoteric astrology is the including science. This must inevitably take shape in terms of energy received, transferred, and used, and throw light upon the abstruse factors which condition the centers. Now, abstruse factors which condition the centers, we might say that they are many and diverse. And direct, indirect, let's see, obvious, and subtle. Let's just say that the Earth is a chakra, and the Earth has all these different rays connected with it, even though some major rays. So any ray that you are looking for, you'll be able to find in one way or another in relation to our Earth and its chains and its globes. And thus it is with any chakra. However, there's a whole hierarchy of influence, isn't there? And some influences stand very high in the hierarchy, foremost, you might say. Other influences are secondary, and still other influences are tertiary or very minor. So anyway, this must inevitably take shape in terms of energy, received, transferred, and used, and throw light upon the abstruse factors which condition the centers, and thus make a man what he is at any one time. The planetary conditioning of the centers is what we can call time-sensitive, or depends upon the different cycles, or phase, cycle of evolution, phase of evolution on the path in which we find ourselves. It is the statement of fact that the world of the occultist is the world of energy, of forces, of their origin, their point of impact, and the methods of their assimilation and transference or elimination. It's a brilliant sentence, worth considering and reconsidering. The world of the occultist is the world of energy, of forces, of their origin, the different planets and stars and zodiacal constellations and other constellations and groups of constellations and so forth, their origin, their point of impact, and that will involve a force, a directed energy. I think I'll just get rid of this here. The methods of their assimilation, because there can be impact without assimilation, and we, you know, a little analogy, you can take a cup of water and you can drink it, but if someone turns a fire hose on you and aims it at your mouth, you're going to have a tough time drinking any of the water, aren't you? So we have to be careful. Impact does not necessarily equal assimilation. Their point of impact and the methods of their assimilation and transference or elimination. As to what is energy? Energy is life. Energy is God. And does that bring us any closer? I don't know. There's naught but energy, for God is life. is God, is that which moves what seems to be, the mover of Maya and of the units of Maya. We could meditate a long time on what is energy. I remember doing this in one class, and you know, it's it leads you into some very abstruse areas. Can there be an energy without any movement whatsoever? It seems it is difficult to separate energy from movement. And when we look at the great absolute, is it an energy per se? Or is it that out of which energy arises with the first apparent movement? You can also ask what moves the great breath. There's some sort of motion and no motion. Let's put it like this. No motion occurs without a mover who stands in the role of energy to that which is moved. But anyway, we don't have to try to be too precise about it. Things appear, things disappear. 1 minute there is no energy of a certain kind present, and the next moment there is a presence carrying a certain type of vibration which has a certain type of impact upon our perceptual mechanism, and we notice a change. So we might say that in a way energy is that which causes change. Of course, since change is perpetual motion, energy is always present. The question is, must energy itself move, or is energy the mover? These get to be philosophical issues and a great internal ability to perceive subtle changes and movements would help us in these definitions. But we always assume that when something in the field of consciousness appears or disappears or moves, there is an energy behind it. So let me look at that. When something in the field of consciousness appears or disappears or moves, we assume that there is energy causing these changes. And then we have to deal with the idea of the causeless cause, which no energy brought into being, as it always has been, and there's nothing other than it. So, nothing lies behind the causeless cause. It is the cause only of itself. But if we use a word like cause, we think of some circumstance or some perception arising. And we can honestly say, I think we can say, the causeless cause is the non, I'll make it capital, arising one. It never arose, and it will never subside. And this is the ground of all being, which in a way is not perceivable, but there are a series of perceptions which move towards its confirmation. So it never arose, and it never subsides. I guess I'm off on a philosophical tangent here. And thus was not, in a sense, caused. We can't even really say that it's the cause of itself, because this takes us in a regression, and a cause always antedates in time that which is caused. So there's no conventional causality here connected with the non-arising one. But anyway, this brought us in this question of the world of energy, the world of forces, the world of moving things, and that which causes them to move. We can look at it in a less exacting manner. I think we should. Because if we get overly specific, we can get off on a tangent and lose the main point of the thought behind the use of the word in a particular context. Unless, however, there is some scientific method of comprehension, some mode of adapting the life to these factors, and some process of experimentation in order to prove the fact, the statement remains relatively useless to the intelligent human being. So we need the entry of science into the field of astrology to prove the efficacy of the astrologically mediated or induced energies. And we have to understand when they do arrive, and we have to attempt to adapt our life to the conditions which they appear to engineer or to bring forward or to make appear or arise. And we have to experiment over time, to see whether some types of the appearance of some types of energies are cyclically determined. So we need to be able to measure sameness of energy and the intensity of what are deemed to be the same energy, or energies. In other words, perhaps there will come a time when we can actually measure the appearance of Aries energy. Perhaps we will see statistically more initiatives undertaken when Aries energy is strong. And maybe we can measure the intensity by the number of undertakings that occur on the planet. Well, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, when spring arrives and the first degree of Aries arises, the sun reaches that point tropically, people do tend to plunge into new things after the winter doldrums and undertake new experiments, push forward in some way and do something new that they haven't done before. Maybe we could even measure the number of such things that occurs, even in a specific field. We're getting to the point where we can pretty well count most of what happens on our planet. Maybe not yet, but the intelligence is increasing to such a degree that we might even be able to measure the number of breaths which humanity takes in any particular time period. Maybe we'll find that under the Pisces influence, that number is less. And under more excitement-inducing signs, more. Numerical analysis is useful in determining the reality of quality. Sometimes I have said that quantity is quality, and by that I mean that frequency determines quality. Anyway, there are all kinds of experiments we can enter into, and they will become more apparent during the next 500 years when Manus is rising to its apotheosis in the present cycle. Maybe Manus per se, without the influence of Buddhi. And then there will be a great clarification in relation to the passage of the energies and forces and their targets and their assimilations and their transferences and so forth, and we'll be able to live far more scientifically with greater control over the efficacy of our evolutionary process. Right now, it sort of seems that humanity often blunders forward under the fourth ray, and if things are conflicted and painful enough, harmony is sought. But there's no need necessarily to touch something that is hurtful, harmful, when one might simply see it coming, anticipate it, and not actually come in contact with it. In other words, a hot stove is deemed to be such after a touch or two, and there's no reason to always touch a hot stove to know that it is hot. After a while, one can be abstracted from that immediate experience through anticipation. And this will bring us somewhat into the science of correct living, according to the art of living, to emerge under the fourth ray, we're told. So some process of experimentation in order to prove the fact. The statement here will remain relatively useless to the human being. So many people disbelieve in astrology, especially intelligent people who watch the way the unintelligent respond to a very childish presentation of the science. And, you know, they are so intelligent, they enter into an area of ignorance by cutting off the higher possibilities of the astrological science. They assume that newspaper astrology is real astrology, and as a result, they fail to avail themselves of the great science of contact, the contact with these etherically mediated astrological energies, which are very real and which can be detected by the sensitive and somewhat evaluated, but not necessarily numerically evaluated in any precise manner yet. So some process of experimentation is needed to prove the fact. Otherwise, the statement about living in this world of energies and forces remains relatively useless. It remains in the form of an hypothesis to be proved or disproved, and of course, Matthew Decay encourages us to do just that. There has to be a general clearing of the forces of opposition and obstruction which disturb so much clear thinking at this time in human history, but then there will be an increasing ability to prove or disprove certain astrological hypotheses. I remember a friend I was talking, he's a good astrologer, and I said, well, what about Taurus and banking? Well, he said, statistically, in what I've done, maybe it's more correlated with Libra. Well, Venus, you know, the planet of money and of value is also there, but maybe Libra had a higher correlation with banking than Taurus did. Depends on the ray too, of course, but at least with Libra there's a strong third ray which relates to money. So he had done some testing, and he doubted the old astrological assumption that Taurus, money, and banking were all closely connected. I know that's a very exoteric thing we're discussing, but he used the statistical method. Had a fairly large sample, and he saw that there was another kind of indication than the one which so many astrologers simply assume at face value. So the man who is attempting to master his lower nature and has the goal of expressing his innate divinity requires a golden thread whereby he can find his way out of the caverns of bewilderment and the areas of speculation and inquiry. What is the golden thread? Well, maybe for different people it's different things. It's really related to the third ray. And render to him the golden thread which will provide release from all the maze of earth existence. It has to do, I'll show you his marvelous quote, maze of earth existence. And it's about the Blessed One, and he is encouraged to recognize the great state of illusion in which he and all live. All is illusion, O dweller in the shadows, come forth into the light of day. Display the hidden glory of the Blessed One, that's the third ray monad. Display the hidden glory of the Blessed One, the glory of the one and only. The glory and the truth will rapidly destroy that which has veiled the truth, the prisoner can go free. And here's the method, the rending of the blinding veil, the clear pronouncing of the truth, and practice right will render to the Blessed One that golden thread which will provide release from all the maze of earth existence. So the Antikorana is like the golden thread in a way. Look up along the line and not along the many lines which in the space of eons you have woven. These hold thee prisoner. It is said in the third ray integration formula, not many lines but one line, one woven line, one Antikorana. And sometimes there is, as a golden thread, a very revelatory occult hint, which can be used as a touchstone to reality. Every once in a while, I think I find a magical word or two, which I attempt to apply for a while, because it seems to give me a sense of what is real, but only for a while, because then maybe another magical word has to be discovered. And what can be a magical word to you may be different from what it is to me. So we need to hold on to that thread just the way, was it Theseus held on to the thread provided by Ariadne when Theseus was in the maze where the Minotaur could devour him if he became lost. Minotaur, in a way, could be like the great symbol of illusion, or death in illusion or through illusion. And the golden thread, perhaps, which Ariadne held at the other end, would lead Theseus to the soul, to Ariadne. So a thread had been laid down by her to help him escape, because there was a love between the two, just the way there is a love between the soul and personality, the two brothers or the brothers, brother and sister, depending on how you like to look at it. Theseus, and the Minotaur. Yep, there it is. Theseus and the Minotaur, and he had to find his way out, and he does slay the Minotaur, but he could still be lost. Theseus was the founder hero like Perseus, Cadmus, or Hercules, all of whom battled and overcame foes that were identified with an archaic religious and social order. Okay, there's going to be some excellent description here, but without the golden thread, Theseus would not have the way of extracting himself from the lower worlds, which are the worlds of illusion, where the Minotaur rules. So many of us are still wandering in illusion. What must I do? And we have to rend the blinding veil, pronounce the truth clearly, and engage in good seventh-ray practice. Very important for the third ray type, and then it's possible to catch the golden thread, which is in a way let down from the soul. Or even, you know, there's other golden threads, other Antikoranas, which will lead into still higher worlds. They are projections from higher worlds in a way, or projections which descend once aspiration from lower worlds goes forth towards them. So if we aspire sufficiently and direct our aspiration, there will be a response, an evocation from the other side, a descending thread, which we can grasp and through the means of which we can extricate ourselves from the bewilderment, caverns of bewilderment, one marvelous pictorial word. We can speculate, yes, yes, but is it, will it ever lead anywhere? Areas of speculation and inquiry following the golden thread leads to intuitive confirmation. Okay. This process of investigation, deduction, and proof, the science of esoteric astrology and its subsidiary sciences will eventually provide. Early in the book, I think he talks about certain sciences. Science of relations. Uh-huh. Well, let's see. That's not, I'm not spelling science correctly. Science. And who could think it would be so difficult? Oh, S-C-I-N-C-E. Science relations, and the entire science of astrology is in the last analysis, the science of relations. I consider the science of relations in a way even superior to the science of relationship and science of triangles. I think there's something about the progressions. Progression. There's eight. And let's see if we can, the mode of progression. Well, early in the book, he discusses various science, some of which are subsidiary. Ah, progressed horoscope. There's one there. Here it is. This is what I'm looking for. It will be obvious to you how much correlating work and how much readjustment of ideas will be needed as the new astrology is worked out into practical usefulness and eventually substituted for that which now holds sway. The new astrology really embodies five sciences. Okay, so astrology is the embodier, and the five sciences are subsidiary. The science of the rays, the science of esoteric interpretation, which is carried out through the science of triangles, the science of the centers, and the science of destiny, which may ultimately have something to do with monadic astrology. So, this process of investigation, deduction, and proof, the science of astrology and its subsidiary sciences will eventually prove, and let me list then, these are, I'll put them in different color here and in a different font, which is smaller, so we'll get the idea. All right, so these are the following. We have the subsidiary sciences, the five subsidiary sciences. But in a way, the science of relations is equivalent, because astrology is really the science of relations to my way of thinking. The great science of relations is the superior science of all, because it can cover the science of the seven rays, the science of esoteric astrology. It can cover all factors, even those which are not specifically astrological, and it can reveal the pattern of the divine purpose. But okay, we can see about that later. Anyway, these are the five subsidiary sciences, and we've been dealing now with the science of triangles and of the centers, and the science of destiny we have not dealt with yet, but the progressed horoscope is the embryonic seed of this science of destiny. And I remember the days it used to be so difficult to progress a horoscope. There were no computers, and you had to do it all by hand. When the calculators came in, it became a little easier, but still extremely cumbersome, hundreds of times slower than it now is. Well, we're moving forward here. And this will be the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 133A. And we are on some page or other. Oh, I think number lock. Okay. 516. Page 516. And beginning Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 133B. Page 516. It really is a very practical area of the book, isn't it? I mean, he's dealing here with techniques, methods to actually prove and substantiate what he has been talking about. I think among the esoteric students, they have the intuition working, they've studied themselves more, they see how things are working. I, like in my own case, as an Aries type on the sun sign, I said, well, yeah, Mars has been very strong in my life, but the esoteric rulership by Mercury makes a lot of sense in terms of how the Aries energy has worked out in my life, you know, as the birthplace of ideas. So an elevated Mercury in Aries as the ruler of Aries esoterically makes sense, more so than Mars in Aquarius, which maybe in the earlier days made more sense, but we always, you know, recapitulate and move forward in various lives. And it probably you'll find the same to be the case for yourself when you look at your sun sign ruler, orthodoxly or esoterically. There's always going to be a movement towards the use of the esoteric ruler, even of the sun sign. One doesn't have to be necessarily the initiate to begin to feel that that is happening.